available all the time. In any case, he felt, the protesters started it. Of course, they are challenging the authority, challenging it by force, and actually, in both Rabah and Ennahda, the first bullet was coming from among the Muslim brothers. This is for sure the starting of the using of fire was on them. I pointed out to Beblawi that most international human rights assessments disputed that narrative. He shrugged. They asked for this. When I asked him if American influence had any effect, he said simply, no. Interim Vice President El-Baradei, who had been leading negotiations with the Brotherhood protesters and served as one of the main liaisons with Graham and McCain, pushed back against armed intervention, arguing that a deal with the demonstrators was possible, according to several sources present at the time. Fahmy, the interim foreign minister, reportedly took his side, though he refused to confirm his position on the matter to me. The decision to do Rabah was a cabinet decision, Fahmy said, declining to elaborate on the breakdown of perspectives in those final, critical days. After the fact, Fahmy, like Beblawi, has struck a defensive posture, assigning blame to the protesters. They had blocked all the streets, he told me, shaking his head. And this area, by the way, is a heavily inhabited area. The largely unarmed protesters, he suggested, were a menace to public safety. This was the influence America's most muscular diplomatic intervention, and an annual military assistance package totaling $1.3 billion, had purchased. At best, a few extra words behind closed doors, shortly before the slaughter. A year and a half before, on a hot Saturday in February 2012, I'd watched as Hillary Clinton filed into a palace in Tunisia overlooking the Mediterranean to deliver a speech about the future of democracy in the region. After Richard Holbrooke's death, I had put together a small team of Foreign Service officers to focus on the global implications of the youth unrest I'd seen vividly in Afghanistan and that then unfolded across North Africa and the Middle East. That February in Tunisia, Clinton was announcing my role as part of an initiative focused on youth outreach and public diplomacy. There was a placard on the podium with a map of the world showing a glowing gradient centered on the Middle East. This was meant to suggest a spreading wave of democratic enlightenment, but it looked more like a blast radius. Clinton appeared small behind the podium in a vaulted chamber at the heart of the palace, a blue and white jewel of a building called Nejma Ezohara, Arabic for Star of Venus, constructed in the 1920s by an heir to a French banking fortune, Baron Rodolphe Deranger. A sea of upturned faces, the kind of optimistic, educated, and generally non-representative youths rounded up by American embassies for photo ops, looked on as Clinton preached the virtues of democracy. You were fearless on the front lines of the revolution, enduring tear gas and beatings. It takes a different kind of courage to be guardians of your new democracy, she told them. Transitions can be derailed and detoured to new autocracies, she continued. The victors of revolutions can become their victims. It is up to you to resist the calls of demagogues, to build coalitions, to keep faith in the system even when your candidates lose at the polls. That means not just talking about tolerance and pluralism. It means living it. On the way out, Clinton, hair pulled back ballerina tight, black and blue jacket billowing, paused on one of Nejma Ezohara's spectacular terraces. Squinting into the sun, she extended an arm toward the brilliant blue of the Mediterranean. Things are changing, she mused. But the truth was that those changes had caught the United States flat-footed and robbed it of credibility on the themes of Clinton's speech. American administrations had chosen to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Middle East's autocratic strongmen for decades. When those autocrats' regimes crumbled and the alliances with them became a liability, the United States was slow to adapt. In the Middle East, as in Central Asia, military-to-military deals had eclipsed diplomacy for so long, we barely knew how to do anything else. Egypt was Exhibit A. Throughout the Cold War, Soviet sponsorship of Egypt's military and constant conflict with Israel were at the heart of the U.S.-Egypt relationship. Bloody skirmishes over land, including the attempt to reclaim the Sinai after which the 6th October Bridge was named, continued into the 1970s. But Egypt's new leader at that time, Anwar Sadat, was dogged in his reorientation of Egypt toward two radical new goals, a peace deal with Israel and closer ties to the United States. Above all, he wanted the Sinai back in Egyptian hands, and felt peace was the way to achieve this. In the United States, newly elected President Jimmy Carter seized on the moment, bringing together Egypt and Israel at Camp David for an iconic 13-day negotiation. One of its outcomes, a peace treaty signed 6 months later, forged the modern relationship between Israel, Egypt, and the United States. Israel agreed to withdraw from the Sinai and return it to Egypt. In exchange, diplomatic relations were restored between the two countries, and Israel was guaranteed free passage through the Suez Canal. The diplomatic achievement was secured with military funds, an arrangement that would blight the relationship for decades after. Under the agreement, the United States would commit to bankrolling Egypt. Since 1987, that assistance has held steady at $1.3 billion per year. The bullets that ripped through protesters during the Rabaa massacre were almost certainly purchased with American funds. U.S. military aid covers the cost of as much as 80% of Egypt's weapons. By 2011, the word Egypt appeared 13,500 times in the Pentagon's database of military contracts. That arrangement reflected one of the oldest assumptions in foreign policy, that you can buy security. For a generation, Egypt appeared to be a proof point for that thinking. The country's repressive leaders, for most of those years the Mubarak regime, helped secure American equities in the region. But from the revolts of 2011 to the Rabaa massacre in 2013, when change swept the region, it betrayed fatal flaws in that conventional American wisdom. Buying security wasn't enough. Years of neglected diplomacy meant that Washington lacked other essential tools of persuasion when conflict broke out. The cracks began to show in January 2011. Revolution was spreading, from neighboring Tunisia to Alexandria, and then to Cairo. That month, thousands of protesters in Tahrir Square rallied around an array of frustrations with Mubarak and his regime, from mass unemployment to corruption to heavy-handed policing. The protesters sweeping the Arab world looked askance at the United States' reliance on Egypt's repressive military regime as a surrogate. But the U.S. was slow on the uptake. As violence began to spark, then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton proclaimed the regime stable. She deployed Frank Wisner, Richard Holbrooke's old friend and a veteran diplomat who had long been sympathetic to the Mubaraks, who informed the public that the president must stay in office. The State Department was forced to disavow its own envoy's remarks. It called for Mubarak to step down, too late and to little effect. In just 17 days, the uprising ended 59 years of military rule. Mubarak was removed, and America's relationship with Egypt was unmoored. A committee of generals known as the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF, stepped in as a caretaker government while preparations were made for the first free elections in Egyptian history, and promptly began a series of vicious crackdowns on civil society. In one December 2011 incident, employees from 10 NGOs were banned from leaving the country. Among them, Sam LaHood, son of then U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. The military leadership was thumbing its nose at the Americans. Ann Patterson, who arrived as the new U.S. ambassador to Egypt in the first months of SCAF's leadership, called that period really, really disruptive. There were some Americans at the embassy. It took weeks to get them out, maybe longer. We basically paid bail, and then they jumped bail. That was the deal. That got the relationship off on a really bad foot. When the elections took place, the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood Party swept the parliament, with its leader, Mohamed Morsi, securing the presidency. It was yet another shift in gravity for which the United States was ill-prepared. The Brotherhood quickly proved more problematic than the SCAF. Worst of all, from the perspective of the American foreign policy establishment, Morsi threw into doubt the core tenet of the U.S.-Egyptian alliance, support for Israel. The politician had, years earlier, described Zionists as bloodsuckers and warmongers, and complained that futile Israeli-Palestinian negotiations are a waste of time and opportunities. Domestically, The Brotherhood's harsh social policies on issues such as women's rights and alcohol consumption alienated much of Egypt's largely secular population. A hastily constructed and fraudulently ratified constitution, with terms favorable to the Brotherhood, further infuriated Egyptians. After just 1 year in power, Morsi faced street protests as large as those that had ousted Mubarak. As protests became more violent, the military, led by then-Defense Minister Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, forced Morsi from power and placed him on trial. Sisi was, in some ways, a return to the status quo ante, a strongman who would hold the line on Israel. "I knew Sisi very well, and I knew it wasn't going to be great, don't get me wrong," said Patterson. "But frankly, he's proven a lot more brutal than I ever would have predicted." Sisi's security forces clashed with protesters who took to the streets, enraged at the ouster of the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood regime. Tensions mounted as the sit-ins and rallies grew, finally culminating in the bloody massacres of August 2013 at Rabaa and elsewhere. In the years since, crackdowns have continued unabated. In the first year after the 2013 coup, under Sisi's rule, at least 2,500 civilians were killed and 17,000 wounded by the police or military. By March 2015, security forces had arrested more than 40,000 people, the majority of them on grounds of suspected support for the Muslim Brotherhood, although leftist activists, journalists, and university students were also detained. Hundreds of Egyptians were disappeared. The repression, according to Human Rights Watch, was on a scale unprecedented in Egypt's modern history. Most of the targeted individuals were thrown in jail on sham charges, or on none whatsoever. As one prisoner recalled of his time at Azuli, an isolated military jail, "There is no documentation that says you are there. If you die at Azuli, no one would know." In April 2014, 529 Brotherhood members were sentenced to death, one of the largest ever mass death sentences anywhere in the world. The attorneys of the accused were denied access to the evidence, and those who protested were threatened. The following year, the same court sentenced Morsi for his alleged role in the 2011 uprising. The former president faced public execution by hanging, with more than 100 others sentenced alongside him. Morsi's co-conspirators included one man who has been in jail since the 1990s and two who had already died. "I would say it's the worst of anywhere I've ever seen outside of a war zone," said Frank Lowenstein, the longtime advisor to John Kerry. Tony Blinken, the deputy national security advisor at the time, offered a bleak prognosis of Sisi's impact. "Over time, and almost inevitably, if he continues to repress a significant minority of his own population, liberals, secularists, moderates, journalists, you name it, all have their voice taken away, and many of them get thrown in jail. And thrown in jail where they're mixed with genuine radicals. That is a recipe for radicalizing a lot more people. And we can't forget that Al-Qaeda was born in an Egyptian jail." Growing concern over the Sisi regime and its use of American weapons did at least spark a debate over accountability. After Morsi's removal, questions arose over whether to abide by the so-called coup clause in U.S. appropriations law, mandating a halt to direct assistance to any country whose duly elected head of government is deposed by military coup d'état until democracy is restored. President Morsi, though divisive, was by any account duly elected. His removal was widely called a coup because, well, what else could you call it? Sisi's military regime had made no pretense of democracy. But with $1.3 billion in annual military assistance at stake, the Obama administration refused to use the word. It first resorted to what the Associated Press called difficult contortions of language to avoid the term. Then, finally, senior State Department official Bill Burns was dispatched to inform lawmakers of the administration's formal decision. This coup would not be called a coup. The most militarized corners of American foreign policy were also among the most constrained, so much so that one of the most obvious coups in recent history could never be called what it was. Those constraints were tightened by the lack of alternatives, There was no diplomatic strategy to confront the disruption that would follow enforcing such a legislative provision. Congress added to its appropriations a requirement that the Secretary of State certify the Egyptian government was introducing democratic reforms, holding elections, defending women's rights, and safeguarding free expression. But the conditions were toothless. The new requirements had a national security exemption large enough to fit an Apache helicopter, or several. Citing extremist activity in the Sinai, the administration soon resumed deliveries of just such helicopters, even during escalating crackdowns. Shortly after the massacre at Rabaa in 2013, the Obama administration quietly, temporarily froze the transfer of several weapons systems. Planned deliveries of helicopters, F-16 aircraft, M1A1 tanks, and Harpoon missiles were placed on hold. It was all larger-scale equipment, rather than the tear gas and small arms being deployed in the regime's urban crackdowns. And other military support, like training operations and the delivery of many other kinds of spare parts for weapons, would continue. In March 2015, President Obama announced a full resumption of assistance. By that time, Ann Patterson recalled, the Sinai stuff had flared up, and the judgment was, yes, they needed helicopters. The posturing on Capitol Hill was just that. In fact, there was little leeway to change the relationship. The problem we would have is that the aid is already committed, said Sarah Leah Whitson of Human Rights Watch. Everything's pre-sold. It was a machine that couldn't be turned off. The Obama administration quietly attempted a more modest reform, signing off on an end to cash flow financing, a preferential system granted to Egypt and Israel that lets them purchase military equipment of their choice on credit, obligating corresponding appropriations of U.S. assistance, potentially for years to come. They lost a really important element with that change, said Patterson. They'll be forced to buy stuff that we think will be useful for them to buy. It was a slim ration of accountability, and didn't offer any control over what was actually done with the equipment. A scathing 2016 audit by the Government Accountability Office concluded that neither the State Department nor the Pentagon had any functional systems for monitoring how American weapons were being used in Egypt. In the end, the halting reform efforts have been harsh reminders of the resistance to change in significant military alliances. Like Pakistan, Egypt was simply too big to fail, in its own eyes and in the eyes of American policymakers. A new array of threats, including the rise of ISIL in the country's Sinai Peninsula, has reinforced that leverage. Competition has played a role in immobilizing the relationship, too. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates have pledged billions of dollars of economic support to Egypt, sometimes offering more than the United States, with fewer conditions. Saudi Arabia, in particular, has developed a cozy relationship with Sisi. Russia, too, has stepped into the fray, with meetings between Putin and Sisi and growing assistance packages. We certainly have influence, Kerry reflected, but our leverage is not as simple a formula as some people assume. We are far from the only actor, and leverage is a two-way street. We needed Egypt's help on a set of issues including ISIL and Israel. As a result, said Frank Lowenstein, their attitude about it is, what the fuck are you really going to do about it? You can't afford to have me fail. That's the ultimate leverage that Sisi has, that he will fail. And that is an extraordinarily powerful form of leverage. Meanwhile, years of dependence on military assistance had convinced both sides that arms and equipment sales were the only currency that could purchase influence, and that diplomatic overtures were essentially cosmetic. As a result, precious little has changed in the U.S.-Egypt relationship since the Rabaa massacre. Security wasn't simply the first priority, it was often the only one. And Washington policymakers reverted to the traditional tools of arms and military financing to enforce it, in part because they had forged few meaningful alternatives. Egyptians suffered the consequences as the United States gave Sisi its endorsement and support. He's been ruthless is a good word. Death penalties, mass arrests of journalists, shutting out NGOs, said General Hayden, the former CIA director, reflecting the common thinking about Sisi among American officials. But when I asked Hayden if there was a point at which that should trigger an easing of military assistance, he darkened. "I'm not prepared to say that," he said. He steepled his hands, peering over his rimless glasses at me. "We make our compromises," he mused. "We may incur a debt for the future." Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Rabaa massacre, was critical of the American response to that crisis and since. "We should have completely revamped the relationship, given who Sisi was, and made it purely transactional," she explained, exasperated. "Instead, after brief pauses, U.S. assistance inevitably resumed, and the relationship looked largely the same as before the massacre." Power knew that cutting off the $1.3 billion aid package to Egypt wasn't politically or strategically realistic, but was among the officials who felt those funds could be allocated more cautiously. "Now the Camp David rationale is over because Israel's Bibi Netanyahu and Sisi have the relationship they need. So much of the logic of giving the Egyptians whatever equipment they wanted was over," she said. "I argued for giving a huge share of that money to Tunisia. We should be rewarding countries who are struggling to progress in the direction we want them to." Moral and ethical dilemmas like this were nothing new in geopolitics, but the particular intimacy between Washington and Cairo made the compromises feel closer to home. Of all the dictators who enthralled Donald Trump once he took office, Sisi appeared to earn the most attention and flattery. Trump reversed the Obama administration's decision to withhold invitations to the White House from Sisi and his top brass. Some of the Egyptians who witnessed the Obama-era relationship were optimistic about the shift. "With Trump," said Nabil Fahmy, the former interim foreign minister, "you finally have the two presidents talking to each other." But for better or worse, even the sputtering attempts at accountability were receding in the rearview mirror. "Sisi is still getting support from the USA," Teo Buttarini, the Italian photographer, said, shaking his head. "At the same time, he is the person who actually ruled to go shoot at the people in Rabaa. He is the person who made the anti-protest law. He is the person who is jailing a lot of journalists." One of the few photographs Buttarini retained from his harrowing day in the midst of the maelstrom was of a tear gas canister, one of many picked up off the bloodied concrete by numb survivors. Several appeared to be American-made. One he photographed bore the logo of CTS, Combined Tactical Systems, a Jamestown, Pennsylvania-based arms manufacturer. It even had a support contact number, with a Pennsylvania area code that, presumably, an Egyptian would have to call during business hours to lodge a complaint. Buttarini never forgot the shouts of the protesters around him, brandishing the empty canisters. "They're shooting at us, the tear gas, and the tear gas comes from the USA." Chapter 21. Midnight at the Ranch. Waking up in the bed of a white Chevy truck trundling through the moorlands of central Colombia, Freddy Torres began to suspect that his evening had gone terribly wrong. The mild fall weather had given way to a cold wind, the forested highlands replaced by low, flat heath. Scattered homes dotted the landscape, and the early dawn was silent. Most worrying were the burlap sacks that bumped against his outstretched legs and the empty bottles of aguardiente. They were filled with rifles. Torres, a young man in his 20s, born and raised in the village of Cabrera, Cundinamarca, an afternoon's drive south from Bogota, hadn't meant to end up here, hungover, confused, and hours from home. The truck ride was the final stop on a liquor-fueled 12-hour bender. Now, three strange men with strange names. Paisa, a common nickname for people from Medellin, Costeño, meaning coast, and another man who, improbably, was also named Freddy, had led him to what felt like the end of the world. It was the early hours of September 17, 2006, and Torres was about to come face to face with the secret costs of the United States' most expensive military alliance in Latin America. In the coked-out frenzy of that region's war on drugs, many of the same dynamics evident in Afghanistan, Somalia, and Egypt have plagued the United States' alliances. Colombia, where the costliest of the region's relationships has played out in the form of the multi-billion-dollar Plan Colombia military and development assistance package, throws into relief some of the worst pitfalls of America's Faustian pacts with foreign militaries. For years, the Colombian relationship served chiefly as a cautionary tale of the human rights abuses, rampant corruption, and explosion of drugs that sprang from America's military interventions in Latin America and its insistence on prioritizing guns over negotiations. But Colombia, in recent years, has also become what U.S. officials described as a success story, a model of how to put civilian assistance front and center in a national security-sensitive relationship dominated by generals talking to generals. That night in September 2006 had started quietly for Freddy Torres. Walking home from a job, he often pulled days-long trucking shifts that took him to the far reaches of the country, he bumped into his cousin Elvire at Arrocola, a neighborhood joint serving as half bodega, half bar. Elvire, always gregarious and fun-loving, never short of friends, was with an acquaintance, the man also named Freddy, and the three ordered rounds of beer. They joked around, calmly whiling away the hours, half-watching children kick a soccer ball around in the park nearby. As evening fell, the young men grew restless. Several drinks in, their new friend Freddy suggested that the cousins accompany him to a bar in Fusa, a bigger city several hours away. After their friend offered to pay for the trip, the cousins agreed to come with him on a lark. Their friend left the store to make a phone call, of which Torres caught one phrase: "I'm bringing two people," and returned 15 minutes later, telling Elvire to go find a car to rent. The three packed into an early 1980s Renault and set out for Fusa, picking up two men, Paisa and Costeño, on the way. A drive that would normally take only 2 or 3 hours stretched through the night, as the men stopped in forgettable bar after forgettable bar, in small town after small town. Just as often, they'd swap cars, a detail that an increasingly intoxicated Torres paid little attention to. Around midnight, after a delay at a checkpoint, the drunk men made it to Fusa, and after several boozy hours at the La Curva strip club and a meal of street empanadas, arepas, and shish kebabs, Freddy, Paisa, and Costeño suggested the cousins join them at a nearby ranch, owned by a friend but long abandoned, to sleep off the drinks before returning home. Dawn was approaching, and neither thought twice before accepting. Clambering into the bed of the Chevy, their fourth car of the evening, Torres and Elvire promptly fell asleep. It was upon waking that Torres noticed the guns. After a long, tense drive, the men parked the car and handed Torres and his cousin black sweatshirts to change into. The new friends that Torres felt increasingly convinced weren't friends led them to an isolated two-room ranch house, seemingly empty and abandoned, and told them to wait in the bedroom while the other men looked for supplies. Torres slipped out of the house to urinate. That's when he noticed fresh footprints in the earth around the house, odd for a supposedly abandoned property. He had been unnerved since their arrival, and he took the footprints as confirmation of his fears, that they were being set up, possibly by more men than the ones they'd been drinking with. Deciding not to wait to learn if he was right, Torres hurried back inside and told his cousin it was time to leave. The two had almost made it out of the house when their drinking buddies opened fire. Dodging the deadly spray, Torres leapt out the back window and ran for a nearby forest, where he hid for nearly 10 hours, as his would-be killers scoured the hills for him. When the sun began to fall, he walked to the nearest town and called the police and his family. Torres survived. Elvire was killed. This was only the beginning of Freddy Torres's strange saga. To his surprise, the military falsely pronounced Elvire a guerrilla combatant in the Civil War and reported his death as a combat kill. Torres launched a campaign to clear his brother's name, which drew death threats. Eventually, an unseen shooter fired through his windshield as he sat parked near his home in Bogota in February 2007. He escaped injury, but after the assassination attempt, Torres uprooted his family and adopted a peripatetic life, changing cell numbers and houses every few months. The authorities, he said, were unresponsive to his pleas for protection. "They don't help anyone," he told me, "because they don't want to have problems with the state." Torres was convinced that Elvire's murder and the subsequent intimidation efforts could only have come from power players within the Colombian military, Eventually, his suspicions bore out when an army colonel who had encouraged his soldiers to kill civilians was indicted for Elvire's murder. The men who went by Freddy, Paisa, and Costeño were never found, let alone arrested. Torres's story matched thousands of others from bystanders to Colombia's victorious war on terror. Elvire was a casualty of the phenomenon of false positives, the Colombian military's long unacknowledged practice of extrajudicial killings. Under pressure from their commanders to create the appearance of success in the war against the guerrillas, members of the armed forces lured in unsuspecting civilians, killed them, and dressed the bodies up as FARC rebels. The deaths were used to inflate the military's batting average. Those who carried out the false positive killings were rewarded with vacation time, promotions, and medals. Victims included farmers, children, homeless people, drug users, the mentally disabled, and petty criminals. Rarely, if ever, were victims card-carrying FARC guerrillas. Until 2008, most Colombian policymakers could pretend the false positives were merely a rumor. But that September, the so-called Soacha scandal pulled the curtain back. Prosecutors learned the fates of 22 impoverished young men from the slums of Bogota, who had been promised well-paying jobs, transported out of the city, and then murdered and dressed up as FARC members. General Mario Montoya, commander of the Colombian army, resigned on November 4, 2008. Prosecutors went on to investigate more than 3,000 alleged false positives by militia personnel in the 2000s. In 2015, the UN refugee agency, UNHCR, reported that the total number of victims of false positives could be as high as 5,000. Colombia was no stranger to civilian executions, but the practice soared in the final stage of its decades-long civil war in the early 2000s. The army took on FARC rebels with renewed fury and was eager to demonstrate progress to a frustrated public and to its American financiers. Defense Minister Camilo Ospina de facto endorsed the practice in 2005 when he issued the so-called Directive No. 29, which authorized the payment of rewards for the capture or killing of ringleaders of the illegal armed groups. The reward was set at $1,500 per kill, a little less than half what the average Colombian took home each year. Civilian executions doubled the following year. How far up the scandal went was unclear, but the practice was common and not limited to any unit or region. UN Special Rapporteur Philip Alston, after carrying out an investigation into the practice, found no evidence to suggest that these killings were carried out as a matter of official government policy or that they were directed by or carried out with the knowledge of the president or successive defense ministers. For Washington, D.C., the false positive killings might have just been a tragic blip in another country's history, but for one fact. Many of the worst offenders were U.S. trained and funded. Researchers found that Colombian army brigades that received more U.S. assistance had been associated with significantly more executions. In Washington's race to support its Colombian partners in their mission to secure the country from so-called terrorists, U.S. military officials and other policymakers often failed to take a close look at the fighters they were preparing for battle. Nearly half of Colombian commanders trained at the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation at Fort Benning have been charged with a serious crime or commanded units whose members had committed extrajudicial killings. Commanders like General Jaime Lasprilla, a former instructor at Fort Benning who sanctioned or encouraged hundreds of killings under his command, were commonplace. Even before the Soacha scandal broke, reports of extrajudicial killings were whispered within the United States intelligence, military, and diplomatic corps. A 1994 cable from the U.S. ambassador in Bogota warned of body count mentalities, explaining that field officers who cannot show track records of aggressive anti-guerrilla activity, wherein the majority of the military's human rights abuses occur, disadvantage themselves at promotion time. A CIA intelligence report from the same year was even more explicit, stating that the Colombian security forces employed death squad tactics in their counterinsurgency campaign and had a history of assassinating left-wing civilians in guerrilla areas, cooperating with narcotics-related paramilitary groups in attacks against suspected guerrilla sympathizers, and killing captured combatants. The Pentagon came to a similar conclusion, reporting in 1997 on a body count syndrome in the Army that tends to fuel human rights abuses by well-meaning soldiers trying to get their quota to impress superiors. And a cavalier or at least passive approach when it comes to allowing the paramilitaries to serve as proxies for the COLAR, Colombian Army, in contributing to the guerrilla body count. But the Colombians, and by extension the Americans, were fighting a war. Often the brass didn't have the time to police their soldiers, or the interest in doing so. On October 28, 1998, Colombia's new president, Andrés Pastrana Arango, stood in the Rose Garden next to President Clinton and became a participant in one of the strangest political press conferences on record. The goal was to discuss the deepening ties between the two nations that would eventually take the form of a watershed new assistance package. This was the first stage of Plan Colombia, Pastrana told me. The first time we really, really talked about Colombia at such a high level. The reporters in attendance had other topics in mind. The first question in the press conference, Pastrana recalled, was, how are you going to explain to Chelsea the scandal? In fact, the question was several deep into the conference, but his recollection was otherwise correct. The transcript of the press conference reads like a layer cake, Clinton valiantly attempting to redirect toward foreign policy, the press corps hammering him about the sex scandal involving a White House intern and engulfing his presidency. Clinton, Pastrana recalled, was stressed. He offered me a Diet Coke. You could tell he was a human being. For the first time, you saw the human side. The surreal juxtaposition continued. Around the margins of the press conference, Pastrana asked for 10 minutes with Clinton in the Oval Office. As Pastrana recalled, Clinton went to his desk and pulled out a map of Colombia, and the two men looked at areas that Pastrana intended to demilitarize. Then, Pastrana said, he asked me what I thought of his answer to the first question, referring to Monica Lewinsky. Pastrana told Clinton he'd done all right. He chuckled at the memory. It was strange, he said. The two men got along. It was good chemistry. The conversations continued and, over the following year, evolved into the plan that would define Clinton's legacy in Latin America. I proposed what I called a Marshall Plan for Colombia, Pastrana said. The result was a $10 billion aid, development, and military assistance infusion. In selling the expensive plan, Clinton appealed to an American public obsessed with drugs. Gallup polls from 2001 show that overwhelming majorities of U.S. citizens expressed a great deal of concern about drug use. Since 90% of America's cocaine was coming from Colombia at that point, it made sense that much attention was directed at the Latin American nation. Clinton had an easy sell. Colombia's drug traffickers directly threaten America's security, he told the public. Plan Colombia would enable Colombia's counter-drug program to inflict serious damage on the rapidly expanding drug production activity in areas now dominated by guerrillas or paramilitary groups. Ann Patterson, who had been U.S. ambassador to Pakistan during Holbrooke's stint in the region, and in Egypt after, was also the ambassador to Colombia for the first 3 years of the new assistance plan. The strategy is to give the Colombian government the tools to combat terrorism and narco-trafficking. Two struggles that have become one, she told me. To fight against narco-trafficking and terrorism, it is necessary to attack all links of the chain simultaneously. President Clinton decided to waive human rights provisions in the funding legislation, arguing that security came first. In justifying the waiver, the president explained that our assistance package is crucial to maintaining our counter-drug efforts and helping the Colombian government and people to preserve Colombia's democracy. Initially, Colombia wanted a 70-30 social-military split. The United States wanted the reverse. The final plan was written in large part by a Colombian, by Jaime Ruiz, one of Pastrana's closest aides in Pastrana's and Ruiz's telling. But it bore the obvious marks of those American priorities. It set aside $1.3 billion a year for a decade to combat narco-terrorism. The first year, more than 70% of the funds went to military and police assistance, including everything from Black Hawks to communications equipment to trainers, to chemical warfare technology. As the former U.S. Ambassador Robert White put it, Colombia comes and asks for bread, and you give them stones. But the remainder of the American money went to economic development, judicial reforms, and aid for displaced people. And the greatest successes of the deal came only as the balance of military and civilian assistance evened, and U.S. and Colombian officials began to recognize the value of rebuilding the country's long-suffering institutions. The United States' entanglement in Colombia was shaped by the same anti-communist zeal that propelled American involvement from Vietnam to Afghanistan. Concerns over drugs would come later. Seeds of the trends that would explode under President Trump, the devaluing and deprioritization of diplomacy, the rise of generals in policymaking, were planted in this earlier period, amid the military adventures of the Cold War. Hundreds of thousands of innocents would become casualties of those interventions. The Colombian intervention began with a special warfare trip to Bogota in 1962, headed by Lieutenant General William Yarborough, commander of the U.S. Army Special Warfare Center, who proposed one of the era's classic proxy wars, using locals to perform counteragent and counterpropaganda functions, and as necessary, execute paramilitary, sabotage, and/or terrorist activities against known communist proponents. Based on his findings, the U.S. helped the Colombian government formulate Plan Lazo, a counterinsurgency strategy modeled on the Phoenix Program in Vietnam. Formally adopted by the Colombian military on July 1, 1962, Plan Lazo was sold to the Colombians as a hearts and minds strategy. In fact, it was an American plot to wipe out communists, aided by civilian informants. Plan Lazo was reinforced by a Colombian presidential order called Decree 3398 that stated, "All Colombians, men and women, will be used by the government in activities and work that contribute to the reestablishment of order," in effect allowing Colombian authorities to organize ordinary citizens into militia groups. Together with the U.S.-backed Plan Lazo, Decree 3398 created civilian self-defense units and hunter-killer teams, instructed and authorized to kill armed or unarmed peasants. The U.S. Army and the CIA began instructing Colombian troops in the same techniques being introduced in Vietnam. As part of a CIA program, USAID provided training to Colombian police at the agency's bomb school in Los Fresnos, where the curriculum included courses like terrorist devices, incendiaries, and assassination weapons. The United States wasn't just teaching the Colombian army to fight the communists. It was underwriting that fight. Beginning in the 1960s, Colombian forces used U.S.-supplied vehicles, communications equipment, and arms to destroy rebel communities across the country. The counterinsurgency campaign against communist campesinos, most were peasants, began in earnest on May 18, 1964, when the Colombian army sent one-third of its troops to destroy the left-leaning village of Marquetalia, defended by a few dozen fighters. The operation was undertaken at the request of the United States with American assistance. U.S. military advisors were there for the planning and the execution. After that first assault, the Colombian government began attacking other self-governing leftist rural communities. That the Colombian initiatives were corrupt and mismanaged, and that they encouraged more bloodshed, was no secret in Foggy Bottom. Secretary of State Dean Rusk and UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson admitted to the moral contradiction, writing in cables that U.S. funding was encouraging rural violence and economic dislocation. And the State Department would be hard-pressed to argue that the prolonged fighting between the leftists and the U.S.-backed Colombian military did much to improve the lot of most Colombians. The underlying class struggle that sparked the conflict persisted as the landless remained disenfranchised and the urban elite grew rich from the chaos. U.S. investment and loans surged during this time, leading President Alberto Lleras Camargo to remark dryly, "Blood and capital accumulation went together." The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, rose up soon after in direct response to the U.S.-backed attacks on leftists in Colombia. After the obliteration of Marquetalia, the few remaining leftists from the area fled to the mountains, where they banded with other rebel groups who together pledged to fight for better conditions for people in the countryside and to defend their followers from military abuses. Their organization swelled rapidly. FARC became not just a guerrilla force struggling for more land, but a political movement pushing socialist reorganization of the country. Rural peasants, indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, landless laborers, unionists, teachers, intellectuals, people of the soil, joined the fight. FARC began to organize schools, medical centers, and social projects, essentially running a parallel state. But the group was still, at its core, a fighting force. Soon after organizing, FARC leaders began training militias in rural areas to carry out attacks. FARC relied on a campaign of terrorism, not only bombing police stations and military bases, but also hospitals, churches, and schools. Kidnapping for ransom provided revenues, until the late 1970s when the group began trafficking in cocaine. During Reagan's first term, Colombia accounted for almost 80% of both cocaine and marijuana that reached the United States. FARC's newfound drug fortune allowed it to attract support from Colombians who were unhappy with the staggering poverty facing much of the country. By 1980, FARC's numbers had grown sixfold to some 3,000 fighters spread across the country. Revenues soared, eventually topping billions. And the violence worsened. FARC's reign of terror targeted priests, politicians, military officers, and even prominent right-wing civilians, often simply to incite fear. In turn, elite landowners hired right-wing fighting forces, many of which traced their roots to the U.S.-backed groups under Plan Lazo. These groups aggressively targeted anyone hostile to their employers. The paramilitaries were everywhere. At their peak, they counted 30,000 people in their ranks and operated in two-thirds of the country. Some were armed by the government and legally sanctioned. And they were brutal. One group, the AUC, killed more than 19,000 people in its first 2 years of operation. The paramilitary death squads over time gained the support of the government, military, traffickers, and even the United States. The White House refused to support any peace dialogue between the government and the leftists, which it decried as narco-guerrillas. In some cases, Reagan's White House went as far as to directly support right-wing paramilitaries as informants or assassins. In the 80s, in one of the more ill-fated partnerships in America's transnational war against drugs, the Colombian Army and the 20 largest cocaine traffickers teamed up to establish a national counterterrorism training school, supported by U.S. intelligence. The group was known as MAC, or Muerte a Secuestradores, Death to Kidnappers, and had ostensibly a simple mission, to thwart FARC's tactic of abducting politicians and the wealthy. Traffickers were required to put down $35,000 as an initial fee. Generals contracted Israeli and British mercenaries to do the training. CIA and U.S. intelligence agents participated. The group was successful in the sense that it was deadly. Eventually, it grew into another paramilitary criminal extension of the army, doing the government's dirty work in the war against FARC, with little, if any, focus on stopping kidnappers. MAC would go on to arrest the peace process led by President Bentancur in the 1980s by murdering over 700 FARC members who entered the political process as part of the Unión Patriótica, a leftist political party. In an ironic twist, many of these paramilitary organizations got into the drug business too, and U.S. dollars sent to Colombia to combat the war against drugs found their way into traffickers' pockets. The result was an Escheresque tessellation of faction and violence. In 1999, Colombia experienced thousands of acts of terror and kidnappings. The homicide rate was a staggering 60 per 100,000. Nearly 20,000 FARC fighters were holed up around the country, netting millions from kidnappings. A full half of Colombia's territory lacked a security presence. FARC essentially governed the entire South, where the government did not dare enter. More than 700,000 Colombians left the country from 1995 to 2000. The violence had grown more grisly, too. The AUC massacred civilians by the dozen, making a name for itself with macabre tactics like playing soccer with severed heads and cutting their victims apart with chainsaws. Clinton's drug czar, General Barry McCaffrey, remembered the violence vividly. "You couldn't drive anywhere in country without risking being kidnapped. It was sort of like dialing for dollars. The FARC checkpoint would search your name, get your worth, and you'd end up either kidnapped or dead in the jungle. It was a vile situation." By the end of the century, Colombians had decided it was time for a permanent peace. 13 million people showed up at the No Mas nationwide protest of the war in October 1999, in a country of 40 million. Later that month, 10 million voted for peace in a symbolic referendum that served as a wake-up call for Colombian politicians. No official political election had ever seen such a high turnout. Andrés Pastrana, who was president at the time and had himself once been kidnapped by the Medellín cartel, said he immediately understood the ramifications of that vote. "No presidential candidate has ever received that many votes," he said. So, after he was elected president, he decided the first thing I should do was try and achieve peace. Pastrana attempted tactics never seen before. He met with top FARC leaders, even going as far as traveling into the mountains to personally speak with the rebel commanders. He granted FARC a demilitarized zone as a show of goodwill. He began official peace talks in his first 6 months on the job. And of course, he and Clinton, after that strange encounter in the Rose Garden, brokered Plan Colombia. Nearly two decades later, that Plan Colombia was considered a success story spoke to just how grim the situation had been before. The costs of the deal were astronomical, in both financial and human terms. The United States had spent $10 billion propping up Colombia's security forces, economy, and political institutions. Only Israel and Egypt received more aid. From 2005 to 2014, more than 170,000 political assassinations targeting leftists had reportedly been carried out. The false positives scandal claimed the lives of thousands. Human rights abuses, some of them enmeshed in American assistance, were frequent. U.S.-made smart bombs were used in the mid-2000s to wipe out FARC leaders outside of Colombia's borders, which often led to the deaths of civilians. Incidents of secret state terror were common. Most famous was the destruction of the town of San Vicente del Caguán in February 2002, an attack that echoed the joint U.S.-Colombian attack on Marquetalia 40 years earlier. Government forces, under U.S. pressure, invaded San Vicente in the prosperous, largely self-governing southern territory colloquially referred to as Farclandia. San Vicente was a successful community with its own police force, new highways and bridges, widespread electricity, quality schools, and a healthcare system. But after a round of peace talks abruptly broke off, Pastrana ordered the military to invade. U.S.-supplied A-37s and A-47s dropped bombs. 13,000 U.S.-trained troops circled the village. The government declared victory, telling the media they had wiped out the supposed FARC camps in the area. And they had, along with a number of civilians, including children and the elderly. Victims of the war seldom saw justice. Militants were incarcerated on farms and in villas, after which they could emerge with their wealth and networks intact, immune from further prosecution or extradition. U.S. extradited paramilitary leaders tended to receive light sentences, just 7 years, a little more than half what street-level dealers arrested for selling less than an ounce of cocaine would serve. Nearly two decades after Plan Colombia was launched, and nearly 70 years after U.S. intervention in Colombia began, the question remained: did Washington's insistence on achieving its military and security aims come at too high a human cost? And could stronger civilian influences at the decision-making table have prevented deaths like Elvire's? When I asked General McCaffrey, the Clinton administration drug czar, whether the United States bore any responsibility for the civilian deaths throughout the Civil War, he was fiercely dismissive. The idea of U.S. complicity was complete illogical poppycock of the worst sort. Just utter nonsense. "Why would that be the case?" he asked, referring to the data suggesting a correlation between U.S. support and Colombian units committing abuses. Why would oversight by U.S. Foreign Service officers and military officers increase EJK and mayhem? It's just complete nonsense. More likely, those units were just more involved in counterinsurgency. Some may well have been involved in more action, which may have included human rights violations. But blaming the U.S. is such poppycock, it's beyond belief. It was a bloody war. There were some bloody things that happened, he conceded. But basically, the Colombian army was the most trusted institution in Colombian society. And indeed, the militaries were often the most trusted institutions in countries marked by these American proxy wars. The uncomfortable question U.S. officials seldom confronted was the extent to which American support elevated those militaries to their status as the only lasting structures in their lands. Whatever its costs, Plan Colombia, unlike later efforts in, for instance, Pakistan, eventually rebalanced towards civilian assistance and laid the foundations for peace. In the plan's first decade, the National Police expanded into all of the country's municipalities, helping knock kidnappings down from 3,000 a year to just over 200. Killings were cut nearly in half, as was the size of FARC's forces. By 2006, Colombia had achieved the voluntary demobilization of more than 30,000 combatants, put an end to much of the paramilitary violence, and launched peace talks with AUC commanders, many of whom agreed to prosecution in exchange for lighter prison sentences. In the relationship with Colombia, unlike so many other similar alliances, there was a holistic development plan surrounding the arms and the human rights waivers. The non-military and military components of the deal reinforced one another. We tried to get Congress to do a free trade agreement with Colombia. We supported Colombian President Uribe in his democratic security efforts to rebuild institutions in Colombia, Condoleezza Rice recalled. But the FARC had to be defeated. The reason you have reasonable peace negotiations now is the FARC couldn't hold Cartagena and Bogota hostage any longer. That more balanced integration of diplomatic and security strategy was at the heart of what ultimately brought peace to an embattled nation. At the end of the day, McCaffrey said, we're talking about the most successful policy intervention by the U.S. since World War II. The United States military alliances around the world present a record of tragedy and chaos, but there are also lessons to be learned. If you look at Plan Colombia, Rice said, diplomacy led. But in the years that followed, the Trump administration would struggle to apply elsewhere the lessons that had made Colombia an atypical model of success. As sweeping budget cuts made the kind of comprehensive, integrated development assistance that had anchored Plan Colombia scarce, and a new wave of arms deals and calls to strongmen appeared to unmoor American foreign policy from human rights concerns, there was little indication those lessons had registered at all. Part 3. Present at the Destruction. Washington, D.C., 2017. North Korea, 2007. There ain't no truce or negotiating with thug lords. Tried conversating, but he won't listen. Tupac, grab the mic. Chapter 22. The State of the Secretary. Rex Tillerson's team was fighting again. So, who's going to go in with him? Margaret Peterlin, his chief of staff, was saying. She looked me up and down with an expression that suggested she'd discovered a pest in the house. We were standing on Mahogany Row at the wide double doors into the Secretary of State's office. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, Stephen Goldstein, folded his arms and stared daggers at Peterlin. Well, I guess I won't be, he told her. Heather can go. He tilted his head toward Tillerson's spokesperson, the former Fox News anchor Heather Nauert. Peterlin narrowed her eyes at Goldstein. Are you sure? She said, with theatrical displeasure. Goldstein didn't reply. Tillerson strode up to the door, cutting the tension. Such discord often simmered just under the surface in the months before Tillerson's unceremonious firing in March 2018, according to multiple members of his embattled inner circle. Often it emanated from Peterlin, a formidable attorney and former congressional staffer who helped draft the Patriot Act after the September 11 attacks and guided Tillerson through his confirmation process. When she was passed a note indicating I'd arrived that day, she'd given the rest of the team an ultimatum. From the public relations staff, only Goldstein would be permitted in the interview. Goldstein had pointed out that Nauert, as spokesperson, would be the one responsible for answering ensuing public questions. Peterlin had insisted there was simply no room. Two staffers said there was another motivation.